Setting up shop.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to a special episode of Setting Up Shop that is actually no more special than any other episode. Hi, it's Dan Woodworker from the UK, and with me, as always, it is Rasmus Lowen, a blacksmith from Norway.
Hello.
And Heidi Jacobs, a potter from America.
Hi, I'm special.
We're all special, but not in the hard R way. So all three of us have been discussing various things today. I can tell how well that last comment's going to go down in America from the look on Heidi's face just now. We are going to talk today about keeping crafts alive. And obviously all three of us are aspiring craftspeople, or we are craftspeople, depending on how you like to describe yourself to others. And I think all of us who listen to the podcast, and most of us in the makersphere, are aware that there are traditional crafts that are disappearing, dying out, because people, the ones who know or have the skills, it's not that they're not willing to teach them, it's just there's not necessarily people there willing to learn them, or if they're willing to learn them, they can't afford to live and learn them and, you know, and make a living from it. And so we just wanted to sort of discuss a little bit in that space, really, and talk about maybe some crafts that we wish we could get more involved in, or elements of our own that kind of tie into that, and to try and do a bit of the storytelling to keep people aware, and just to talk about it in general and try not to get distracted by bunny rabbits running past my window in the field next door. ADHD, not diagnosed, but borderline there, just to catch me unawares every now and then. So then, this is something that Heidi specifically wanted to speak about. So we're going to jump to Heidi for the first part of this conversation. So I'm going to flannel for a little bit to allow her to sort of think on a few things. But if we start with this first, if we think about what it is that each of us do in our own craft, if there is something there that we are either potentially struggling with to keep our own craft going because of outside impact, costing materials, that kind of thing, or there's that kind of really niche little thing that we all like, that was a thing we enjoy doing, but it's not necessarily efficient to do things that way. And maybe it's more of like an inside baseball kind of thing for if you are a potter or a smith or a woodturner, it's like you guys who are doing the thing know you've done it, but it's not visibly obvious to the end user. So there's a couple of little things we can discuss around that, I think. But we'll start with Heidi first. Is there, you know, a particular aspect of this that you feel is impacting you at the moment?
I think most people know that pottery really is like endemic for like all cultures. It's not just specific to English or Japanese or Korean or American. It's something that our ancestors, you know, predating written history, have been making pottery from whatever that they could get their hands on, whatever earth they could get their hands on, and baking clay for whatever suits their needs. So anything from, you know, and Gobe pottery to, you know, the fine china that you see from the dynasties and everything. And what I always find interesting is that because it is a craft that can be done with the least amount of technology, It's really interesting to me how the gateway to enjoying the craft is very nominal, because you could do pit firing, you can build your own furnace kiln, you can do all of these things if you understand the science behind it and the basics of the craft. So it, from a universal standpoint, like pottery is available to anybody at any level. But I think there's a lot of commercial gatekeeping that happens in our cultures, where it's like, oh, well, you need to first go to university and get all the information to understand the science behind it. And then you have to, you know, invest in all this equipment. You have to invest in a powered wheel and an electric kiln and all of these things, when really it's like one of the most basic art forms that there ever has been. And reminding people that, like, I think I'm the problem too, because anytime people are like, oh, I really want to get into pottery, I'm like, okay, well, you know, it's not a craft that you can just like be a little bit into, because there's like all of the supplies that you have to hold on to. And, you know, there's buying the kiln and buying the wheel and all those things. But there are a lot of people out there that are like makeshifting what they need to be able to create in this medium. And I was reminded of that because I went to get some supplies, raw materials, and the cost due to tariffs and due to, you know, other inflationary things, my costs have gone like 15 to almost 30% more when it comes to different things. So the realization there is that, okay, well, if I'm going to bring my costs down, what are the things that I am purchasing for my business that are just commercialized things that I can get cheaper by substituting an ingredient that I can get locally? Is that something that's even possible? Can I mix my own clay? Can I dig up my own clay? What material do I have to use as an additive to my clay to get a similar look to my product? And I think those are all things that people within my community are starting to think about more. And we're leaning more into that just basic understanding of the work. And I think in these scary political and economic times where it's like, you don't know today or tomorrow if people are going to have the extra money to buy your work, you're still going to have the need to make it. And then there's the conservancy of the craft too. Like, I have a need to make it. The only reason I started a business was to sell the overflow. and pay for what I wanted to make.
Pay
for my addiction. Exactly. This crack habit. But ultimately, I think there's opportunity for us to, like, even if shit doesn't go down, right? Like, there's still opportunity to really take a hard look at the whys, the hows, and is there any opportunity here to address some of my processes that I don't necessarily need all the technology for? Like, I'm using Wi-Fi to check my kiln. Like, I don't need that. I didn't need a kiln with a controller box that automatically shut off when it didn't ramp to the right temperature. There's my old kiln was just, I had a little cone. You put it in there, it melts, it shuts it off. That's it. That's all I had. And if you go back even further to like digging a hole and putting wood in it, you control the temperature by sight. You look at this is similar to Rasmus U with like looking at your metal to see how hot it is by the glow of the metal, or if the sparks start shooting, you know you've gone too hot. For me, if things get past the point where it's starting to be molten and start collapsing, I know I've gone too far. So don't add any more wood to the fire, or you know, any more fuel to the fire. So there's so many things in my head right now because of all of this and because of the expense. And then like, oh, I just changed my prices. Do I have to change my prices again? Like that whole atmosphere of, oh shit. Yeah. What's happening?
So there's a few things that to break down there. One I'll touch on very briefly, but I think is a whole other subject to us in potentially we'll cover some of this in the after show available on Patreon, which, you know, $3 a month, and you guys can listen to that as well. Or you can just sign up for free, but you won't get to listen to the after show, but you will get possibly more notifications of stuff happening. But the main point I want to bring up is you mentioned about how long it is that people have been doing pottery. Some people who listen to this podcast may not be aware, but my degree is actually in archaeology, and I did archaeology for like 4 or 5 years. And one of the things that one of the proudest things I found was a Bronze Age cremation urn. So when you consider you're talking British Bronze Age is like, well, I'm not going to get into the actual dates, partly because I can't remember, but you can Google it and look it up and then argue yourself about how accurate that may or may not be.
Is it, I guess that's something like 3000 to 500 before Christ or something?
Well, you can Google it. That's what the internet's for. We're glossing over that because we're not gonna go down that exact date. I was always rubbish at remembering dates. I was always better at looking at a thing and going, that's from this era. Same as you are looking at steel or looking at clay or looking at wood. You're like, oh, this is from this, you know, most likely from this kind of thing. And what I was getting to is the fact that the guys and girls who made pottery in the Bronze Age, you're talking about a time where they had no choice other than to cook with fire. They had no choice other than to bake with fire. They didn't tend to have permanent setups as such. It was all about what was local to them, like literally within a couple of hours walk, because then you'd have to carry it back. Like if you're going to dig out heavy clay, you're not going to do it half a day's walk away. You're going to set up camp right next to where the clay source was. And but they, my point being is that they all made functional pieces, but every single one of them that has ever been found has had decoration on it. Every single one of them. That would be really simple decorations. It would be like line marked, sometimes done with fingernails, other times just done with a stick. But all of them have had something on them to set them apart from another piece, or to dictate, you know, it, and some people would argue, oh, well, it's just a mark and say this one's for food, that one's for water or whatever. But you, you can look at them, you can look it up and see that, no, this is someone who's going like, oh, yeah, and I spend this time on doing this thing. Now, wouldn't it be cool if I like did this, and let's see what happens when we put it in the fire. And archaeologists love pre-recorded times when there's no written record, because it means that you can make up these great, wonderful stories about how there's so much ritual involved behind all of this process. And it was about, you know, you're putting things in the fire, so you're calling forth the old gods and you're praying to them to make sure that something comes out and all this kind of thing. And the reason why they love it is because you can't disprove it, because there's no written record anywhere to say that which way it was to be sown. But I think there's definitely something there that we can relate to on how humanity, no matter how old the craft is, function has always been there, but has never stopped people from going, yeah, but what if you just did that? Wouldn't it be prettier? Wouldn't that just look a little bit nicer if you just did, you know, because at the end of the day, like a bowl shape, you know, there are a number of them, but really they could all just be the same thing of maximizing carrying whilst minimizing weight. That's really all it was for. But then they've added this kind of play to it as well. Mm-hmm. But I think one of the other points there, Heidi, which is definitely a cause for concern, is, you know, we do live in an age of mass consumerism in all three of the countries that we're in, parts of the world that we're in. We live in the age where people are more than happy to buy cheap. And let's be honest, the amount of people who go on about like, oh, no, I don't buy from this company because they use child labor in a sweatshop in this country. And it's like, right, OK, but you're still holding your mobile phone, right?
Yeah.
You know, there's the hypocrisy on a lot of that those kind of levels and that sort of thing. And I'm not condoning anything, and I'm not slamming anyone for their belief systems on that. But the difficulty of trying to sell a handmade product to a person that either is a luxury, which in the economic climate we're in at the moment is very difficult because it's a luxury and therefore not necessity and therefore a lot less likely to be bought, or would replace their other equally functional piece that's a lot cheaper but made outside the country that you live in. And trying to persuade them that they should support that, particularly if you know in your heart of hearts, well, this isn't my primary source of income, like I can't, you know, no one wants to be a bully to someone to part with their money, and you never should be, but it can be soul destroying when you're stood at that market and you've been there for like 4.5 hours, 5 hours, and people have kept looking at your stuff and walking by, like particularly as we're getting into the colder months of the year or the wetter months of the year, and you just, please someone just cover the pitch fee kind of thing. And it can make you feel like your stuff's not good enough. And I want to make it really clear to everyone now who's listening that that's not true. It's not about your stuff. It's not about the piece of you that you've put out on that table for people to look at and judge in front of your face without realizing what they're doing. You are more than good enough. It's just that at this moment in time, the set of values that people are assessing things before they buy them are very, very different. It's a hugely different marketplace than it was 3 years ago. You know, or if we want to go back far enough, pre-COVID, you know, the new PC and AC for determining timelines, I think, really, when we're talking about the stuff that we do. So yeah, materials wise, that's a big one. And I'm seeing more people starting to stop, if that makes sense, you know, doing their craft. I mean,
yeah,
you know, my day job is selling resources and materials to woodworkers and woodturners. And the hobbyists are not coming in as often as they used to. And they certainly tend to be from the older generation, who maybe have a bit more spare cash around and a bit more spare time than the younger generation. So yeah, it's a concern, because during all this kind of stuff, then people will retreat to just buy the necessities. And unfortunately, all three of us don't really supply necessities when there are comparable ones of a much cheaper availability. I've spoken for far too much now. We're going to go across to Rasmus and see what he says, because, you know, the price of steel, I'm sure, will fluctuate as well. But it'd be interesting to get your perspective on, because yours seems to be a little bit different. People come to you because they want traditional, they want like the older craft, because they identify blacksmithing as being that thing. They don't necessarily come to you because they're looking for the everyday functional.
It, yeah, it seems to me like most people come to me because they have realized they need something special. They need something they can't get a hold of otherwise, or they just need a little something done by a small shop because the big shops don't have the time to do small custom things.
Yeah.
And I would argue it's one of the most common things I get a request are like people in the immediate area that just discovered me and go like, oh, I need help like fixing this thing. Or can you make this like tiny custom hook or bracket or something?
Yeah.
Just because they don't know anyone else who can do it. So I'm in a very unique position in that way because, yeah, there's not a lot of people that want to work with metal and especially hot metal.
Yeah.
But everybody has the capacity to do some woodworking. Like you say, Heidi, like clay is different. It's both super basic. You need nothing except your hands really to work it, but you need everything else that goes with it if you want to do it proper or quickly and make money from it. But cost-wise, yeah, steel prices have gone up since before the pandemic by a great deal. But compared to the hourly rate or hourly wage in Norway, that's still not a whole lot unless you're doing like big jobs or railings where like you're using a lot of meters of steel.
Okay.
When I'm making nails, like the material cost is cents, and it went from being less than a cent to now being maybe two, maybe three.
I find it interesting that you raise the point that it's local people who come to you for a little thing. So one of the things that I wanted for a long time was to, in effect, resurrect that kind of village woodturner, village craftsman kind of ideal, where literally that you'd have people locally go, oh, can you help me with, you know, a draw pull knob has broken on my whatever thing, can you make me one that's the same shape?
Mm.
You know, like the little jobs like that, that exactly as you said, the big manufacturers, if there are in your country, they're not going to pay any attention to that. It's not cost effective for them to deal with. And I liked that romantic ideal of someone, you know, you can provide through the craft and your training and everything that you've done, something for the everyday person that they're going to remember and appreciate and then go, oh, so-and-so did that for me. And then they'll come to you with another little one and whatever else.
Yeah.
And what's interesting, I think, from that is the fact that the more you do it, the more you realize why larger companies won't do that. Because the amount of time spent working out, right, okay, I need to make just one of these things, then in actual fact, the cost of one of these things is probably sometimes an hour to 2 hours of my labor plus materials,
yeah,
plus a profit margin. And it's not cost effective to try and run a business like that, because if you charge properly, less people are likely to take that job or bring you that job. However, every now and then you will find that person who appreciates the level of craftsmanship of the work you're doing, and then they will just pay it because they recognize what it is they're paying for.
Or they're desperate enough. Like,
yeah,
I need this thing remade, fixed, or whatever, and there is absolutely no one else. And
yeah,
as long as I have the money in my pocket, like there's no comparison, because like, yeah, if it's talking like $1,000 grand to replace or fix something and you don't have that money on your bank account, then yeah, you can't do it.
Yeah.
But when you're talking of quote unquote smaller items, and yeah, it's not cost effective at all because you're doing the weird custom thing.
Yeah.
But they're still hopefully willing to pay it sometimes because there's no alternative.
Right.
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because, I mean, there was a bit of a revival here. So in the UK, they've got a list of endangered crafts. And I haven't looked at it recently, so I couldn't tell you what some of the ones on there are. But some of them are really, really fascinating when you look at them and you go, oh, I didn't even know that was a thing, you know? But I do know that for a while, I think I'm right in saying that brush making was on there.
Yeah.
And there's a couple of guys local to here or a couple of people in the maker community who have kind of, they've started doing their own spin on brush making and they're kind of going, oh, you know, I do this and I do that and whatever. And it's interesting to me because you can see the artist making a brush for it to look like a piece of art that could have a function compared to the craftsman who is making a functional brush as efficiently as possible in order to keep the costs down, in order to sell more, to make people happy to buy more of his brush.
Yeah.
And you can go into a whole realm of the difference between a brush and a broom and various other things that I don't know anywhere near enough about to talk about. But it's amazing to see the things that, you know, people will look at a craft and again, they'll go, oh, that's a shame that's going. But that's as far as they'll take it.
Yeah.
And so what I was going to sort of lead into was talk about what is it that any of us do to kind of educate and to keep the craft alive, as it were, from people. I mean, I know I will go around and I'll do demonstrating, but more often than my wood turning demonstrations are at a wood turning club. So it's a level of kind of, it's preaching to the choir, really.
Pretty invested,
Yeah, so the alternative to that is, you know, I have occasionally done demonstrations to the general public at events. It's not something, it's too messy to be able to do at a craft fair necessarily. But as I mentioned, I think several episodes back, maybe last season, I've got an opportunity next year to potentially do a three-day event at a steam rally, where I will then be doing wood turning to kind of demonstrate that in front of people, as well as potentially selling items. And that for me is definitely an opportunity to say, hey, look, have you ever seen this? Because I can remember as a kid witnessing someone on a pole lathe when I was like 9 or 10 at a Roman reenactment kind of thing. And that's a big difference between that and, you know, just not being aware, just not understanding how are these things that I'm using to eat my food from made.
Yeah.
You know, so what I was just wondering if what sort of thing you guys do to sort of promote your own craft in a way, Heidi?
Well, I get invited often to do like pop-ups at some of the shops that I sell my wares at. So I'm able to like either present videos or kind of talk through my process. And that's been a lot of fun because there's like actual consumers that are like, oh, I didn't realize there was that much involved, or, yeah, oh, that's why it's so much more expensive to buy a mug from you versus Walmart. I think for pottery, at least in my region, there's a certain amount of knowledge already in the zeitgeist because it's very much a part of Appalachia,
yeah,
and our culture. So there's not, you can't go too far before you run into people that have an understanding of it, have done it in high school or college. You know, there's enough of a wealth of people that at least have a basic understanding or have tried it, so that it's not like mind-blowing when people, yeah, see me in practice, but it is a reminder that it's still something that people do. They're probably in the last, like during COVID was when I saw a lot of people investing in their own home wheels because, yeah, you couldn't go to the studio anymore. And I'm starting to see some of our local craft facilities that offer pottery, offer more engaging classes, like, more than just open studios. Like, hey, in 3 weeks, you're going to learn how to make this specific thing, or, yeah, you're going to learn this specific technique, which is super exciting to me because historically those facilities were only just offering basic wheel throwing and there wasn't really a whole lot of curriculum around it. And, yeah, so it's telling that maybe people are more invested after they've taken those like beginner classes to like really understand the different techniques. And, you know, there's people doing specialty classes of like decorating and all of that thing, which are keeping things alive. And, you know, one of the things that I've been interested in and just haven't had the time is, you know, pitching a class to one of these facilities and saying, hey, I'd like to teach this technique, or I would like to either maybe be a TA for somebody that's actually teaching something so that I can kind of learn how their methodology is with like passing the craft along. But up to this point, I think I've just been kind of doing online like demonstrations and those kind of things. So nothing too much in person. It's not a whole lot of people want mud everywhere.
I think it's an interesting point as well that, like you say, there's a lot more people, certainly in your area from the sound of it, who have, you know, done bits at school or whatever. But I have to bring up the point as well that both of you have crafts that have got very popular television shows.
True.
Like, you know, there's Forged in Fire for particularly aimed at weapon making, obviously American-based show. And then certainly from the pottery world, there's, you know, Great Pottery Throwdown from the UK. I don't think they've done an American version of that yet, Heidi.
There's a Canadian version.
There's a Canadian version, yeah.
I forget his name. He does it. The guy with the Seth Rogen.
Oh, is he? Oh, okay.
Is the host for it. It's the Great Canadian Throwdown or something like that. Okay.
Yeah, so there's quite popularized kind of shows. And I think they could be both good and bad. Good in the sense of, hey, look, there's this thing, like watch how stuff used to be made. And then we'll bring an expert in and show like, oh yeah, I can make 40 of these in an hour or whatever it is. And all of that kind of stuff. And I think that's certainly gone a long way to raise the profile of ceramics and also forging, you know, for good or for bad.
There's also blown away, which is
blown away, of course.
Glass blowing, yeah,
the glass blowing one, but just
intense.
I think the thing is that there, you know, you've got to remember from a TV show perspective, there needs to be a level of drama and jeopardy available to all of these within a certain realm of still able to be safe, even if there's drama and jeopardy. Like, I don't think, as much as I'd love it, I don't think there's ever going to be a wood turning variant of a show. Like, they've tried a couple of times in the UK of like Britain's Best Woodworker, and they just encompass the entirety of woodwork into one thing, which is hilarious, because if you think of things like Forged in Fire, it's like, well, that is solely focused around weaponsmithing.
Right. Yeah, it's very niche.
It's very niche out of this broad subject. I mean, they tried the welding one, didn't they? And I think that managed like one season or something, because they tried to go too broad with it. It was really good. I enjoyed watching it. But there's...
I know you're going to cringe, but I really like The Repair Shop.
That's fine.
I think that show, like, showcases some of those like more niche crafts that you're talking about, that maybe there's not a whole lot of drama in
I wasn't repairing even aware a that watch got showed in America, so that's good to know.
It's on BBC One.
So for those people who may not have seen it, the Repair Shop is a show that hits a very specific niche, and basically people will bring along something that, for whatever reason, is dear to them, and they'll go to this mystical barn of myriad of makers who all happily work together like Santa's elves without getting mess in each other's workspace, and just happen to be the resident experts on site ready for that episode to be conveniently placed to be able to repair the things people have brought in. But they will genuinely, you know, they'll come in and they'll have like, oh, this is my grandfather's watch and he brought it back from the war and it's never worked. It'd be really nice if it could be clean and it could work, but we know there's like a gear missing or something. But they will then show you the person like making the part that they need to repair it, and actually cleaning it and repairing it and talking a little bit about it. And it is very much a still for entertainment show. So they don't go too far in the weeds with anything in case people might get bored or might actually learn something. So they kind of move it along quite quickly, but they are glimpses and windows into crafts that allow you to see that, no, there are some things still worth repairing. There are some things still worth like keeping.
And that people know how to actually.
Yes. Yeah, exactly that. Mm-hmm. And to be fair to him, the guy who's the main presenter on that show, I think, is one of the main people who sits on the board of the endangered crafts list to like try and bring it back in the UK.
Like,
I possibly,
Jay Blades? Okay,
yes, I think it's him. Yeah. So it's definitely, you know, the shows like that do help highlight and put a spotlight on various crafts. But I'm just going to sit here and be grumpy because there isn't one specifically for wood turning. Even though the Great British Turnoff is such a good name for a show.
Oh, yeah, they'll turn it off.
You know, like, you know.
That is good.
Would be applicable to most wood turning, let's be honest, for the majority of people. But yeah, I think there's, it's that kind of thing of people's awareness of a craft and how it's directly impacted on them.
Oh, because for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, 14 years ago, if someone mentioned wood turning to me, I'd be like, well, that's something for old people. And I didn't even really know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I was very dismissive of it as a craft or having any interest in it at all. And now I've manifested the fact that I am an old person and I do wood turning. So, you know, it's all...
Well, I definitely didn't think pottery was very sexy at all. When I was in art school, I was like, I don't want to do that. I want to make sculptures. Like, I don't want to make functional things.
No.
But now here I am. Yeah. Happily sitting in my studio making the same mug over and over and over and over again.
And Rasmus just always liked hitting things with a hammer, so he did just nothing really much changed.
Yeah, no, that's just the same. We are doing something really fun when it comes to showing off blacksmithing in Norway pretty soon, actually.
Are you allowed to talk about it?
Yeah. I mean, I've not kept quiet about it. I just don't think we've mentioned it on the podcast before.
Mm-hmm.
But I managed to harass myself into being a part of organizing the Maker Faire in Oslo, specifically because I pestered them about the fact that, well, you got a lot of electronics and robots and like modern makery things, but you're not really doing anything for like the crafts and the trades. Yeah. So like they have had a couple of blacksmiths forging a little bit with the kids outside, But then he's also standing next to someone who is using a CNC with pancake batter to make custom pancakes.
Right.
So it's like, yeah, you're not really doing a whole lot for the crowds, but I like the fact that the blacksmith is there. He's making noise. I can smell the coal and like, yeah, that's cool. But I managed then to get involved in organizing it, because if you don't need to do something, you need to do it yourself. If you need to do something right, you need to do it yourself. That's the one.
Yes.
English. And I somehow have ended up getting permission to put a power hammer up in the middle of Oslo, outside the main library.
That's so fun.
Outside the library. Outside, please, you need to have quiet, please.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, some form of like, you know, posters up around saying, quiet, please. People are power hamming.
Yeah.
Hammering, even.
Hamming.
Yeah, you need to pound a ham with the power hammer.
Yeah.
Yes.
Ham the hammer. Ham and the hammer.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
That's really
looking
exciting.
Forward to that.
So you're running a power hammer outside a library. So you've gotten the thing to help organize this, and you've gone, that's not big and loud enough. We need more big and loud. What are you doing about any of the other traditional crafts, Raz?
We've got some bookbinders. We have got some traditional timber framers, traditional wood carvers.
Excellent.
We've got some
stone
like
carving?
whittlers and spoon carvers and that kind of thing showing up. A good friend, Tadia, is actually doing that. And I think that's mostly... Oh, and actually, I think I got told today that a weaver with a loom has signed up and might also bring their thing.
Amazing.
But there's a whole lot of things. I've reached out to a few people and going like, hey, are you interested in this? And either not heard back or they've been busy. I was talking to the restoration workshop at the main cathedral up in Trondheim, where they do like stained glass, they do plaster moldings, they do stone carving, the blacksmithing and timber framing, and like all of the things. And they were super interested in actually sending like some of everybody down to show up like the complexity of everything that goes into maintaining a massive cathedral. But then they realized they already fully booked themselves for this autumn.
Yeah.
Hopefully next year though, we'll get like, especially just stone carvers, just bringing some of those people in going like, yeah, you can do this technically. It's not that difficult. It's difficult to do it quickly and beautiful.
Yeah.
But if you're going slow, you can still manage to get something really cool out of it.
I love it. There's we have a local Renaissance festival that happens here for like all of September and into October. And there are permanent booths for a blacksmith, a glassblower, a ceramicist. Then, of course, there's like the acting stage where they do like all of the plays and skits. And then there's the people with the horses and the lances up over the hill and everything. But like, that was the first time I ever saw blacksmithing in person was at the Renaissance Festival. And it was always interesting to me that it was like so niche of a thing to share that it was like within a niche community type thing too. Yeah. It wasn't just like, hey, we're in the square for like a national crafts day or like a, you know, citywide celebration of, you know, blue collar or anything like that. I was like, no, it's so niche that it's niche within even that community. Yeah. But it's good to see like Maker Faire coming back around and being more about holistic making. Cause that was one of the disappointing things when we went to New York City Maker Faire was like, it was all geared towards programming, 3D printing, CNC, you know, Dremel was a huge sponsor for that.
And by all means, like those are important sides of making and crafts. But Maker Faire has often felt for me like it's organized by computer nerds for other computer nerds. And then you're sort of missing out on so many other aspects of making.
Mm-hmm.
But like Maker Faire Hanover did a really good job, I feel, of like getting all kinds of makery things into one big space. So that's sort of where I originally had this idea of like, but we're doing something similar, but we're missing out on half the stuff they're doing.
Yeah.
Granted, in Germany, they have easy access to crazy Dutch people who like cosplaying post-apocalyptic things with flamethrowers. So it's like, maybe we can't do that in Oslo, but we can try to do a lot of the other things.
Yeah, I mean, I think from memory, though, the last time you just showed us elements of it is that Oslo kind of went a little bit far the other way because they had people cosplaying as stormtroopers.
Yeah.
And it's like, which is not a problem if there's also the booth to go, hey, look, this is how we made the costume.
Yeah. So I did talk to like the 501st Nordic Garrison also, because a friend of mine is in that community, and go like, maybe you should sign up for this and not only walk around in costume and be awesome, but talk about the making of.
Yeah. Yeah. Because that's the whole point, isn't it? That's like how you reach out to the group of people and go, no, there's a lot more to this. I haven't bought a costume. I've made the costume.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Oh, it's almost Halloween too. Yoo-hoo.
Oh, yeah.
Sorry, we're getting off topic, Dan.
No, it's absolutely fine. I did want to bring back a little, and in fact, no, we'll talk about that in the after show. What will it be? How will you know? Secret teasing, blatantly. I think there's definitely a thing there about like keeping people awareness of the craft, but also I think you said there, Heidi, and imagine you're similar there as well, Rasmus, like I witnessed people making things as a child and it fascinated me.
Mm.
Now, regardless of how it was made, like what we're talking about, whether it's ceramics, wood turning, whatever, but I could very quickly see, oh, that over there interests me, that over there doesn't, like quilting doesn't interest me, wood carving, oh, okay, that's kind of cool. How's that happening over there? You know, and you can almost do like a hot or cold. Like I would love it if there was a way that you could have just a big tent with like all of the traditional crafts in it, and then you just release the children into it.
That is what I'm aiming for.
And they can go around, but the people who are all in there doing the crafts are the ones who are passionate about it, who are good demonstrators, who are like, you know, carrying on. And the blacksmiths aren't allowed to cheat and just make a loud noise and play with fire and sparks to get the kids' attention right at the beginning.
Then you can't do anything.
But the fact that children would have the opportunity to go to the different ones and go, you can tell when a child is gone, like, I'm not going anywhere, that I need to see this. I get to play with mud and it's a job. Like, mm-hmm. give me the potter's wheel, you know, all of this kind of thing, rather than you have been escorted here as a school trip.
Yeah.
This is, you must write a report about which three crafts are blah, blah, blah. No, don't do that. Let them free and like, just, you know, escort them to the extent of making sure they're safe, but let them find the thing that they just want to sit and watch for like an hour.
Mm.
When in this day and age, the attention span is so short. Like, find the thing where they want to ask questions. Don't tell the child to shut up because someone's doing a demonstration and talking and the child wants to ask a question to know an answer. Let the child ask the question to know the answer. Like, that is, to me, is more encouraging than anything else and more important about keeping the craft alive. And I have to go on that record as recording something about how children are important because so many people think I hate kids.
Yeah, I did.
But it's the thing of like making sure that, you know, you encourage a passion in someone to sort of like allow them to believe what is true, that hey, you could do this as a job.
Yeah,
like, this thing that you see that fascinates you, if you come and have a go at it and it still fascinates you, and then, you know, we show you the mundane bit of it, or the bit that's like, hey, this isn't quite so glamorous, but you're still kind of interested, great.
Yeah,
because I think the reality is, as much as, you know, you can be older and you suddenly discover a new hobby or whatever, and you can then bring in your skill set of you're a marketer or something like that in your day job, and then you find a passionate hobby and then you're able to tell lots of people about it. That's fantastic. But the reality is, most people who pick up a hobby, they're okay at their job.
Mm.
They survive at their job. They're not excelling at their job. They're okay at their job. If they were excelling at their job, they probably wouldn't have time for a hobby that wasn't like sport related or something, because all of our hobbies, like you said, Heidi, take a lot of investment in time and in mm-hmm. money and setting things up. You have to go all in. You know, you can't get into wood turning and go, oh, well, I don't really need a lathe. You know, like you've got to buy the lathe and you need the tools and then you need the, you know, the extraction and the wood and all the rest of that stuff. You know, it's very difficult to sort of do that with minimal effort at home. There are some things you could do. You can rig up a drill in a jig and kind of like do little things with little chisels, but you know, ours have quite a, not a high barrier to entry, but there is a financial barrier to entry to all three of ours if you're going to take it seriously.
I built my own wheel.
Yeah,
shit was shit. I think that like if there's a means to an end, like there's always a way of figuring out ingenuity to like do certain things. Say like, I need a spindle, but I also need a piece of metal shaped a certain way. And, you know, I need this ceramic thing because it's going to heat. Yeah. And I needed to protect things. So like understanding, like back to the repair shop, like the whole theme when they bring stuff in to like have it repaired is that they're utilizing, maybe it's a functional clock that also has decorative pieces on it. They're going to each of the specialists within that barn, the magic barn, and saying like, okay, the gears on this need tuning. And this piece of wood is cracked and needs replaced, but we want to make sure that it's the same species and the same, close to the same grain so it can be hidden as a repair. And we need, you know, this ceramic to be cleaned up and maybe it's cracked and we need to hide the cracks. So they have like those three different people that are doing that. The idea, I think, for most makers is everybody just wants to be able to do everything themselves. Yeah. And what I'm finding in my community, and I've been asked to like bid out some work where I think maybe it was the pre-show you were talking about it, or maybe you just said it about needing a knob for a piece of furniture.
Yeah.
So I have friends that are high-end furniture makers, and they came to me and they like pitched this idea. Hey, the client really wants some organic custom-made ceramic hand pulls. Is that something that you'd be interested in doing? And you know, he came up with the design for the furniture, pitched me some ideas about like, you know, different textures that he might want or different things. And, you know, we got it up to the concept stage. Unfortunately, the client decided to pull out at the last second and just buy like regular hardware. But it was a place where it was like, oh man, you know, combining these aptitudes, combining these crafts. And I think I had mentioned before about wanting to join the Craftsman's Guild here, mainly because I wanted to work with other people that have a similar mindset about an age-old craft and be able to like share work and maybe collab on a lot of things, which I think is also a way of kind of highlighting, you know, that those crafts aren't dead and that, you know, there's a lot of use out of those different things. Like I've turned lids for my pottery, and I think I've come to you and you suggested some different books that I could use for me that, you know, it's adjacent, right?
I mean, I mentioned earlier about the romantic ideal of being like, you know, the village woodturner or the village smith or whatever it is.
Yeah, but like, I'm the village idiot.
Mm. I was just going to say the other one would be is that thing that so many of us have talked about, which is just like a series of barns in a yard. And like, you know, I mean, imagine knowing that you're going to your workplace is literally like, you there's a square courtyard and like I've got one corner or side or whatever, and then you guys have each got a space, and then there's, you know, there's the weaver over there, and there's, you know, all of these different crafts all in one place. And, you know, realistically the only sign you'd have to hang on the door other than open or closed is no peopling today, please. You know, like I'm having an introvert day type idea.
Yeah. But it's like Soulcraft in Cleveland.
Yeah, sure. It'd be the ability to be able to go, I need to problem solve this and I can't get out of my own headspace. So I'm going to walk over and chat to any one of these other crafts and say, this is the issue I'm having. What would your suggestion be? And asking the same question in the next person and the next person. And by the third person, you've probably muddled together through some various different ideas and go, oh, yeah, that actually makes a lot of sense. Yeah, thank you very much. And then you rush off and do your thing. And it just, that concept of the closeness of a community all sharing the same ideals. Like I've been to a few places, there are a few local to us where you can rent a space, and then like, you know, downstairs is the stained glass window maker and all of this kind of thing. The problem is with all of our three crafts, or certainly mine and Rasmus's, is noise level. You know, like it's not just the amount of space you need, but like if you're running machinery or if you're, you know, it's a noisy thing to be doing. And so you tend to be like pushed into a barn out somewhere on the fringes, which is all fine as long as it's cozy and you can still get traffic of people coming to buy your stuff. But there definitely seems to be like these pockets now. And the pockets are shrinking of the craftspeople around. You know, you've got the hobbyists who are dabbling on the side. And exactly as you said, Heidi, a lot post-COVID are now going, well, I've done the basics. What's the advanced class? Like, I want to learn the thing. And some of them will learn it from YouTube or TikTok or whatever. And they may pick up bad habits and they may pick up good habits. And there's a whole debate around that. People want to have that separately. But the point being is if they're still hungry for more information, you know, this is why the giving back through teaching or demonstrating or, you know, potentially writing a book or articles or whatever.
Or being that person in the community.
Yeah. Yeah. Like showing people, hey, no, don't, you don't need to throw that away. I can repair that for you or whatever. Just, you know, the hardest one is always when the partner is throwing parts away that you intended to repair, but you haven't had that conversation yet, or it's been 2 years and so they get fed up. But, you know, keeping a craft alive is it's so important, but it can be incredibly difficult. There's a documentary, very briefly, I have to say poorly filmed, but the person who did it did his best at the time, of the last of the British wood turners who used to turn ivory. Like, and he was specifically, he was an ivory and hardwood turner. And that was a distinction that was made back in the day where every village did have a wood turner. They would have, you know, and you would have a softwood turner and you would have a hardwood turner, and the hardwood and ivory turners were like this whole separate group. And like, you know, you start getting even more niche, a bit like, you know, you would have someone who would be a coppersmith as well as a steelsmith, as, you know, all of these things that a lot of people may not be aware of were all their own subgenres of information and skill set. And there's this video on YouTube of this guy, and they're trying to film him like turning ivory and turning handmade threads to make like a 3 or 4 piece chess piece out of ivory, you know? And like, it's the kind of thing where the technology to film someone wasn't available soon enough to be good enough to film him when he was young enough to potentially make a really good documentary. It's still worth watching if you're into that kind of thing. The guy's name was Bill Jones. So he was Bill Jones, sort of ivory turner, or Bill Jones wood turner, or something like that. He wrote a couple of books that I've got that were quite amusing, and had some good project notes in them. But doing things like that, being able to capture with their permission the way that someone who is that good at their craft, at a time where they can reflect on it, they can talk about it, and it's not too late to share that kind of information, yeah, I think is exceptionally valuable. Because if we know they're disappearing anyway, then it's definitely something that we all need to be able to try and be aware of, and to keep going and to keep showing people and say, hey, look, this is relevant. This is part of how the world was made, and it still goes on today.
You are actually touching on part of the reason why I'd like to teach so many classes. Because and why I want to do more blacksmithing classes for kids specifically. Not because I love kids all that much, but because I think it's a really important way of keeping the craft alive. Like, get as many people aware of the fact that it exists, and have as many people as possible try it out. And the younger they try it out, the longer they will have to live and think about the fact that it exists.
Right. Yeah. I was being very rude and not listening to you at all then, Raz. I was looking up the Soulcraft Makerspace website that Heidi dropped into the chat earlier, and I was just really liking the fact that their tagline immediately underneath is, don't be a spoke, make the wheel.
Yeah, mm-hmm. I like that one too.
Which I think is incredibly relevant. But no, I mean, you're very right. I mean, in some ways, fortunately for me, wood turning is difficult to teach to small children. There are physical boundaries to it that don't always allow it to be that easy.
Yeah, but is that any different from blacksmithing though?
Well, you can just give them a smaller hammer and a smaller piece of metal to hammer on, and the anvil just needs to be lower.
Until they go and grab the hot metal, because they don't have the brain space to know it's hot.
Well, yeah, that nearly happened to one kid, but
you'd like to think they only do that once.
No. Yes, then that's sort of the expression we have in Norway, once. Like, burnt kids smell badly and then they learn.
We waited until our nieces and nephews were like 12 to have them turn pens.
Yeah.
Like, there is like an age point.
Yes. Absolutely.
Like, Carver's been on the wheel since he was 3.
Yeah. And but that's just, he's just been sat on the wheel spinning.
Well, yeah, he did that too. No, I mean, maybe he was 2. I have videos of him, you know, I'd send her the clay and then he'd, you know, poke a hole in it and play around. But like, there are little beginner level kind of projects you can do. I don't know that I would have him around the forge, to be honest. He just used the bandsaw for the first time.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I think it very much depends on the kid. I have I have forged with 3-year-olds, and they are in it and they get it.
Three-year-old.
3-year-olds. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. But they're Nordic 3-year-olds. It's
yeah,
slightly
true.
Different.
They're stronger than me.
You know, like we're talking about taller. The country where you give them a knife at birth. It's, you know.
Yeah, like normal people. But like I've also forged with adults, and especially people like in their late 50s and 60s, maybe 70s, where like they keep making the same mistakes over and over and over again.
Yeah.
So it's very individual. But like if I want to have a kid like less than 6-year-old sort of learn to be independent in the blacksmith shop, yeah, I'll have them work copper cold. I'll have them learn that.
Oh, yeah, that's
yeah,
cool.
they can heat that up, then they can quench it and they can work it cold again. But they can learn, because the trick of blacksmithing is the physicality. It is to learn the technique, to learn how to swing a hammer and dare to be forceful enough. That's the difficult part.
Yeah.
Everything else is easy to understand, but learning the muscle memory and building the muscle memory, that's the difficult part.
I do find it quite funny that the two times I've tried forging, both people told me that I was hitting things too gently.
Oh.
And
yeah.
Which I think surprised at least one of the teachers. Not that I'm a hulk of a man, but certainly at the time I'd been going to the gym a lot more than I have done recently, you know, and 6 foot and weighing nearly 94 kilos. And I'm there going tappy, 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 tappy. And they're like, no, smash it. Come on. You're trying to have, you know, the metal out and all this kind of thing. And I'm like, yeah, but I know I've got more control doing it this way.
Yeah. But that's the problem. You're aiming for too much control because you're insecure about how to do it.
Yes, no, absolutely. But I also am, I'm fairly certain, as I mentioned earlier, that whole thing about doing what draws you in, that blacksmithing is not for me.
Mm.
I can respect it and appreciate it as a craft, but it's just not, it's not something that floats my boat. I get bored with it very quickly, which is hilarious because people who meet me think I'm a very frustrated and angry person and assume that smashing things with hammers would be like right up my street. And it's just not. It just doesn't, it doesn't, it's not a craft that, I will go out of my way to learn to then try and keep alive, but I will absolutely encourage people to have a go at it.
Yeah.
Like you really need to, any craft, always have a go at it first before you decide whether it's for you or not, but then encourage others to do it as well.
I think maybe I have the same approach to wood turning as you're describing for blacksmithing, or like it is fascinating and I have tried it and it's kind of like, yeah, thing spins. I introduce steel, it gets smaller.
I think the difference is there though, Raz, is that I feel like I need you to come here and have a lesson with me now as opposed to the lesson that I gave you way back when. Because the lesson that when I taught both of you before was like I had taught maybe once before and I had been turning for maybe 4 years.
Right. Yeah.
And I think the confidence I've got now and the way of being able to explain how things are and aren't happening and being able to just sort of encourage a lot more and make sure you get an end result. Again, you might still realize, working with wood's not for you, which wouldn't be a surprise as a blacksmith. But I think you would probably look at it differently.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I would love that. And maybe next time I come over and need to do like a blacksmith tool run, maybe we can find the time.
Absolutely. Before we wrap this up, I'm going to actually do a shout out to a YouTube channel that we don't normally do, but this is one that most of our listeners will be people who would love to see crafts not die out. And we all know that one of the countries best at keeping traditional crafts alive has been Japan, but they are still seeing similar things happen. But the channel that I'm going to shout out, I'm not going to try and pronounce, but I will spell it. It is at AOYAMA. So that's AOYAMA and then the word square.
Aoyama.
Sure. And that is the official channel for the Japanese Traditional Crafts Guild. And they are some of the most relaxing, beautifully shot, whilst being, you know, instructional and giving an explanation of traditional crafts that I have ever seen. I mean, the wood turning one I will occasionally put on to like send me to sleep, because it's just that whole like relaxation, just kind of everything's just the noise from it and the everything is fantastic. But they're very well shot in their kind of like, they'll show you the location where in the Japanese islands this place is, and you know, this is the home of whatever the craft is. They've got things like, you know, the Japanese parasol making is on there, And some of it you'll be looking, going, oh yeah, that all kind of makes sense. And then all of a sudden something will happen. And you go, whoa, hang on a minute. What? How did they do that? What just happened? There's like a marquetry box guy on there. So he does a huge amount of all these intricate patterns in marquetry. And you see him and he's gathering all these bundles of different colored pieces of wood together that have been cut very precisely and sticking them all together. And you go, oh, okay, yeah, that's fine. And he just, you know, he does this thing. And then the next thing you see him do is he's glued all this block together and it's all perfectly flat. And then he takes a Japanese plane and he just slices a piece off the top and makes a veneer out of it. And then that's what he uses to inlay in the box. And so all of a sudden you've gone from the, well, that's a high level of precision and that's a thing, but I kind of understand it. And it's all like, oh, okay, yeah, they make the pattern. And then he does this, just this sweep, and you're almost like, that is like samurai sword cutting a candle top kind of level of precision kind of thing. So they are fascinating to watch. I binge watched a whole load of them when I first found the channel, and there's probably a few I haven't seen recently, which is a good thing because it means I get to watch them all over again. But for those of you who are passionate like we are about this sort of thing, that is definitely something worth watching. And I will probably have to be reminded to post about this on our Instagram for those people who haven't found it. But
there will also be links in the show notes.
And there will be links in the show notes. Yes, of course there will be. For those of you then who are not fed up of us already, then thank you for listening this far. We really appreciate it. If you've got any thoughts on future subjects or guests you'd like us to get on, or if you yourself are someone who is relatively well known in your community, we might not know who you are, please feel free to reach out to us and say, hey, I'm not introverted enough to be objecting to being interviewed. And we can always have a conversation. We are available collectively at setting_up_shop, S-H-O-P-P-E on Instagram, and info@settingupshop.com, no underscores in the email address. You can find me at tarants.co.uk, tarants.co.uk. You can find Rasmus at Rasmus Lewin, L-O-E-N. And you can find Heidi at Whitehall_pottery.
Hooray!
It's been lovely having this conversation with you two. And I look forward to the after show conversation as well. I'm sure people have got some juicy bits of gossip and other conversation to happen in there. And if anyone wants to listen to that, just a reminder, you can sign up to us on patreon.com. Find us under at Setting Up Shop. And $3 a month will get you access to the after show. And until next time, goodbye.
See you.
Bye-bye.